Blog Talk Radio.
Today on Backroom Politics, it's Tuesday. That means it's probably a primary day. Oh, wait a minute. There is a primary today in Maryland, D.C., and Wisconsin. They hold primaries today. And if we're talking about primaries, that means we try, yet again, try to handicap this race. Who is on the bubble? Who could step away? Obama is taking shots at the following. A, the Ryan budget. B, the Supreme Court for ruling on Obamacare. C, all the above. We will talk about the Trayvon Martin shooting down in Florida. We're going to have D.C. community activist Joe Williams on to discuss this issue. This and Tell Me a Story live on Backroom Politics. Good afternoon, everybody. It's Tuesday here in a lovely spring day here in Washington, D.C., our nation's capital. I know, if it sounds like we're coordinated and we know what we're doing today, it's largely because we're back live in Shelley's back room. This is Backroom Politics. This is Backroom Politics live on Blog Talk Radio from Shelley's back room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. As always, you can join the discussion with us here at Backroom Politics by calling in 619-638-8477. Again, that's 619-638-8477. Joining me, as they do every Tuesday, although now it's good to see everybody here in person, to my left, he's a former 8-term member of Congress representing Washington's 2nd Congressional District. He is the former Vice President of Burlington Northern Railroad. For government affairs, he is the Honorable Congressman Al Swift. Al, how you doing?
Great to see you back.
I'm so glad to be back in D.C. I soon do not blend in that part of the country right now, I got to tell you.
With that yellow sweater on, I thought there was a new cab company coming to town.
Well, we've been on the air for a second, Al. Jeez, sitting to my 11 o'clock as he does every Tuesday when I happen to be here in town. He is the former Undersecretary of Commerce. He's a former longtime staffer on the Hill on the U.S. Senate side. And he is currently a very, very distinguished fellow over at the Stimson Center. He is the Honorable Alan Moore. Alan, how you doing?
I'm doing well. And it's nice to be in your physical presence again.
It is. It is. It's good to be home. And I will tell you, by the way, can we say on the air congratulations on your impending nuptials?
Absolutely.
Wow, that is fantastic. That is great news. Congratulations.
Congratulations.
To my 12 o'clock, as he does, staring me down every week when I'm here, he is the former floor chief for Congressman Gerald Ford. He is the former vice president of government affairs for the National Broadcasting Corporation. He is longtime D.C. insider Bob Hines. Bob, how are you, sir?
I am very glad you're back. We missed you here. Al and I would sit here and look at each other and wonder where everybody else was.
Well, you know where I was. I was pretty open about it. To my right, he is a longtime Washington insider, former executive director for the Maryland Democratic Party. Carl, welcome back, sir. Thank you very much.
Welcome you back. And I understand that you got a little,
get away,
what, 4 minutes?
Yes.
You got a little gray, more gray on your beard than
I will tell you right now. Yeah. Oh, there's a reason for that. There's a big reason for that. To my right, he is the vice president of the Eurasia Center for China Affairs. He is a bar-certified attorney in the great state of New York and the District of Columbia, and a member of the Supreme Court Bar. He is Dr. Ralph Winnie. Wow, welcome back.
Glad to be back, and good to see you, Jeff.
Yeah, thank you. Lots to talk about. So it's Tuesday in a presidential election year. Probably means, oh, that's right, there's a primary today. And, by the way, there's primaries in two states and one that is really, really bugging to be a state. We've got primaries in the great state of Maryland, the great state of Wisconsin, and the District of Columbia. First, let's talk about the lead into what's going on. Congressman Al, just looking at the jockeying for position, the rhetoric that's been going on leading into Wisconsin in particular, It almost seems like the GOP is starting to fall in line, not so much wholeheartedly embracing, but kind of like, yeah, okay, it's Smith.
Yeah, I think grayheads realize that for some time the party's been hurting itself with the way primaries have run, and they want to stop the blood. It's also interesting that the endorsements are mild. You know, they're not jumping up and down saying that that Romney is the greatest thing since sliced bread, but that they think he is better than for a continuation of the role.
Bob, when we look at going off of Al's statement, the kind of lackluster, is this a sign that maybe the GOP establishment could be losing some of its hold on the rest of the political base?
No, I don't think so. I think that what you see right now is more and more known as the establishment is recognizing and pleased, I might say, I'm pretty sure, pleased that Romney is clearly the front runner and will probably be able to pretty well close things down fairly soon.
Why should that please not just you, but what would many consider the inside the Beltway established Republican Party?
Well, you know, it's going to take a little time to heal some wounds. If we're not united by the time we're at the convention, you really have shortened the time frame that your candidate has to do the things you have to do to win a national election campaign, particularly one for the presidency. So, you know, it will be helpful. And sooner the better that we know who the candidate is, and we can start using that knowledge and his issues and how we want to address things so that we can be ready to go right out of the box after the convention.
But, Alan, you know, when we look at what Bob and Al talked about and we look at the dynamic that is out there right now, Is there a possibility that this can be totally healed before Tampa, or can it even be somewhat, can there be a Band-Aid of some sort put on this even before today's primaries?
Well, I think within the party, it can be healed before Tampa, if once the way is cleared and people get behind Romney. The question is whether it can be healed in the general election, where these guys have done a lot of damage to each other and have provided ammunition and ideas that will be used in the general election. It's not that this stuff wasn't going to come out anyway, but it's unfortunate when you've got some very aggressive and even ugly things that Republicans said about each other, that particularly Gingrich and Santorum said about Romney, that those quotes from those guys will be available to the Democrats. Having said that, I think the Republicans will unite. Will they have all the enthusiasm one might hope for? No. When have they had? It's a diverse party. The greatest passion is on the conservative side, but that's just a slice of the spectrum. They're not going to be as excited as they might be, but there's going to be the excitement here is not going to be so much for Mitt Romney because he's the answer to their prayers, but for Mitt Romney as an alternative to a president that Republicans are united in wanting to defeat.
Carl, you had a comment.
Yeah, I had a comment. First of all, I agree the Republican Party should come together before Tampa. But then you've got the governor of Wisconsin who says, I don't know why this should end. I think this should go on. And I'm sure that you're going to have Santorum and Newt Gingrich, even though wounded at this point, they're still going to want to go on.
Ralph.
Yeah, and I think if you look at what happened four years ago on the Democratic side, it went all the way to the summertime, and they ended up selecting arguably one of their best candidates in Obama, while 4 years ago you had the Republicans doing almost exact same thing and trying to wrap it up early. They selected what some people arguably would say is a weak candidate who didn't make a sharp, clear contrast to Obama.
Well, Alan Moore, did in fact, I mean, when we look at 4 years ago, did in fact picking McCain
over Mitt Romney back then? Was that kind of a knee-jerk reaction to a base?
No, I think that it certainly wasn't a knee-jerk reaction to a base, because McCain himself was not that conservative. You remember that it was Santorum who 4 years ago embraced Romney as the conservative alternative. It was every time you do this, you have to pick from among the candidates who are available. The Democrats picked from Obama and Hillary Clinton and John Edwards, who at one point, you may remember, was in the lead, and then he got dumped, and we tend to forget about him. When the Democrats united around Obama, it wasn't with universal enthusiasm. There were a lot of Hillary Clinton's, then Senator Clinton supporters, who were horribly, horribly angry and distressed, and were very slow to come around to Obama. And then eventually they did. They began to see his potential, and it was a unique and wonderful opportunity for the Democrats to win. I don't know that Republicans picked the weak candidate. Who was out there who was so great, who could have beaten Obama on the heels of 8 years of George W. Bush, a couple of wars, and a lot of problems, and the economy falling apart?
Bob Hines.
To follow up on what Alan has just said, the Democrat Party had a very vigorous primary fight for 3 years, 3.5 years ago, and it wasn't over until into the summer. They united. Why did they unite? Well, they united because, number one, they had a pretty good candidate. You know, Hope and Change was a good mark after a good comment, a good idea to lead, because the party was so unhappy with what they had to deal with George Bush for 8 years. They united against Mr. Bush, against McCain, because they wanted to get rid of Republicans. Really, they didn't want to see any more of any Bush's policies. I think you will find that as soon as the Republicans have a nominee, and even before that, you're going to see the party beginning to come together, and it will continue to come together. Why? Well, they may not think that Mr. Romney is the hottest thing they've ever seen, but they know one thing for sure. He's not going to continue the policies of President Obama, and they think that is probably, if you look at the polls, that seems to be the one thing that is so important.
Al.
And they have one thing going for them. And that is that anybody who's played politics very long realizes that people are much more likely to vote against than they are for. And so in this case, that will help bolster the Republicans among those people who want to be against President Obama.
But, you know, when we look at 4 years ago, Al, I want to go to you on this. It seemed like the Obama campaign came in a little weaker than, let's say, what we saw in Hillary Clinton. But the Obama campaign was strategic and stealthy enough that they plinked off the opposition, some with negative ads, some with policy attacks, that they just almost shot their way into first place. It seems like the Republican Party was trying to do that. Some of the leaders, i.e. Santorum, i.e. Gingrich, were trying to do that, but they haven't been as successful. Why is that?
I think that a lot of it was that they underestimated Obama, and specifically Hillary Clinton's campaign underestimated Obama. They let him get too far before they tried to stop him, and then they couldn't stop him. Had they woken up to the fact that he was as talented a campaigner as he was earlier, there's a good chance she could have taken the nomination.
Carl.
She, unfortunately, the Hillary campaign was very, very disorganized at the beginning, which is why they had so many failures at the beginning. They were disorganized, they were not together, and they fell behind, and then when they fell behind, as Al says, they could never catch up. The other side had Ted Kennedy, and the late Ted Kennedy, a great Democrat, a great leader, who really kind of pulled things together for Obama, where he might not have had that if Ted Kennedy had not endorsed him and Caroline had not endorsed him and others. So when all that fell in line, his campaign got a tremendous boost, and Hillary was never able to catch up.
Alan Moore.
I think the other thing that happened 4 years ago, and I agree with Carl about the role, the important role that Ted Kennedy played, because it gave some extra stature and credibility to Obama, but give Obama credit. He was smart. He was fresh. He was new. He was different. There was an excitement factor.
I mean, he just came off a very popular very popular Democratic convention 4 years before, where he gave a stunning speech.
Right, and he was an exciting sort of alternative. Hillary Clinton, bless her heart, because she I think had credentials that dwarfed his, was old news, not exciting. It was the whole Clinton legacy, the very mixed legacy of her husband. And here was this new, fresh person who people like Kennedy were willing to get behind. And there was an excitement factor that was unique, I would say, to him. There was also some excitement for Hillary being a woman who might be the candidate and who could have been the first woman president. And that, of course, was part of the tension among the Democrats. So it wasn't that there was no excitement around her, but Obama was even fresher and more exciting, and that was the battleground.
Ralph.
And I think at the end of the day, Obama was able to close the deal with Hillary and her supporters to get them on board with his campaign. And I think now the establishment is uniting around Romney, and it's going to be important for Romney to close the deal with the conservatives in the Republican Party. Otherwise, he's not going to be able to beat Obama.
Congressman Al, all this being said, we look forward now to today's primaries. D.C., we can knock D.C. out in a second. More than likely, Romney will get the delegates from D.C., all, like, two of them. It's 19. It's more than that. But basically, it's basically the Bazooka Joe of bubblegum wrapper today. Alan, you disagree a little bit.
19 is 19.
That's true. Well, that's true.
That's 19 that Santorum won't get.
That too is true.
Exactly.
But we're pushing forward to having Mitt Romney almost solidify the deal today. D.C. is going to be a given, but when we look at some place like Maryland, Maryland's going to be a little dicier. Maryland, you've got the liberal Republican base somewhere around the Beltway heading out to the Eastern Shore. You've got the more conservatives out in the panhandle, out in like Frederick, etc. Is that a factor today? Is that going to play well to Santorum, or is this just going to go to Romney three ways around?
Well, the panhandle might go for Santorum, but the rest of the state is, and I'm not too sure about the panhandle. Maryland, as you say, is kind of a moderate state, and I don't think it has the I don't think Maryland has the kind of enthusiastic Tea Party type Republicans that would reluctantly probably go for Santorum.
Alan, go ahead.
Another factor that's new for us in this area is we're seeing some ads on television for the very first time. For Virginia, there was nothing going on because you'll remember that neither Gingrich nor Santorum qualified to run, and it was Romney versus Paul, and there was no advertising done. In this case, there is some advertising going on, a little bit by the Romney campaign and some of it by a super PAC. The super PAC is the ads that are dumping on Santorum for his history of voting for big spending and debt limit increases and so on. Something we'd heard about, but we're seeing on the nightly news. Romney's been running a very interesting ad that's positive about him. It's a person who used to be an employee, presumably of Bain Capital, whose daughter, age 14, went missing in New York City. And the whole ad is him telling a story about his daughter, 14, went missing in New York City, and Romney shut the firm down and said, everybody is spending their time finding this guy's daughter. 3 days the firm was shut down until they found the little girl. He said, that's the kind of man this is. It's a powerful ad. And I hadn't read about it or anything, and suddenly it's on local television. So it's just been interesting to get a little of the flavor of that. Santorum is not on TV at all.
All right, but Carl, you know Maryland politics, both sides of the aisle as well as anybody. when we look at Maryland, can the conservative base in the panhandle be enough to maybe edge Santorum over the top tonight in Maryland?
I don't think so. You know, you've got liberals in Montgomery County, and I assume liberal Republicans in Montgomery County. You've got the orbit of the Baltimore Sun, which is a fairly liberal base. The Eastern Shore, that could go to Santorum. And I'm interested to see those counties, which are Allegheny and Baltimore and Montgomery, et cetera, that are on the line with Pennsylvania, to see if there's any spillover there from the fact that he had been a senator in Pennsylvania for so long.
Interesting point. Ralph?
I was going to say, Connie Morella carries a lot of weight in Maryland, and she's firmly behind Mitt Romney, so I really see her endorsement of Mitt Romney bringing in a lot of votes for him.
Yeah, but hers was a very liberal district to begin with, so I think you're right. Connie is well respected, so that sure isn't going to hurt her, but it's a naturally liberal area.
Right, and they're naturally liberal Republicans in Maryland for the most part that are active in the party.
Okay. Well, yeah, go ahead, Alan.
The reference to Morella and these endorsements reminds me when we make these conversations about the Republican establishment. Today's Republican establishment and today's Democratic establishment are not what they were 30 and 40 years ago when this, or even 25, when those terms were being used. Today, it's elected officials who may or may not have any clout, but unless it's the mayor of Chicago, they don't have any proven ability to get votes out because you have to be alive to be able to vote. And
not in Chicago.
That's my point. Unless you're the mayor of Chicago, you can't get votes out because you have to be alive. So in the other parts of the country, I don't think endorsements mean very much. Newspaper endorsements don't mean that much. It's better than nothing. It's better than a stick in the eye, and it's better than the endorsement going to the other guy. But and I think it gives voters a little degree of comfort. But for a primary that they're not passionate about, does it get them to go vote? Not necessarily. So it's not nothing, but it's not much.
Tom, but I want to bring up the point that Alan made. You know, his take on what is the Republican establishment, it seems to be the Republican establishment of, according to Alan, the elected officials. Everybody outside of that is in the periphery. Is that accurate? I mean, is that today's establishment for the GOP, is who's elected?
Well, yeah, the answer is generally yes. The establishment are the people who approved their ability to win, who approved their ability to lead, and whether you're talking governorship, senators, whatever. That has always been the establishment. What is also true is around the core, let's say, of the establishment, those highly elected officials or appointed officials, you've got a whole series of bundlers and fundraisers, you've got a series of messaging people, you've got a series of PR people, you've got people who have data, polling data from elections and counties, and they know how it's going to vote. There's all kinds of people that circle around that basic core, and it's a pretty big number.
Interesting point. Al, is that something that is maybe hurting the GOP a little bit? Is that perceived base or that perceived establishment that is the elected officials versus the evangelicals?
Oh, I think that the problem is the evangelicals don't completely agree with the Tea Party. And you've got many kinds of liberals. So I think they have some impact, but it's not like the solid impact that you used to have when one party or the other would get it organized and it was a great big road grader and it just went down the pike and paved the way. That I don't think exists for either party in very many places today.
Well, okay, we're going to take a quick break here. When we come back, we're going to continue talking about the GOP primary today on a larger scale and how important this is for the survivability of Rick Santorum and Newt Gingrich.
This is Backroom Politics live on Blog Talk Radio from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We'll be back in 3 minutes. Stay with us. Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., where we're all around the table yet once again here in D.C. We're continuing our discussion on Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Backroom on Blog Talk Radio. You can join the conversation, by the way, by calling 619-638-8477. But we're going to continue on with our discussion about the primaries today in the District of Columbia, the great state of Maryland, and the great state of Wisconsin. We're going to go now talk about five things to look for. Our friends at Politico, who we love, came up with five things to look for, and we'd love to get our roundtable takes on it. The one thing that's interesting here is, Santorum seems to be hobbled in his campaign right now, but yet seems to be on somewhat of life support. But we've been saying the same thing about Gingrich, and that man continues to jumpstart his career every 2 seconds. The big question, though, for Santorum, according to the five things to look at in Politico, is the margin of victory. Number one, and I'm going to go to you, Alan Moore, is there a possibility? Now, again, we've handicapped this thing, and our record isn't exactly stellar, but is there a possibility that Santorum could eke out a win in Maryland?
In Maryland? You mean in Wisconsin?
In Maryland.
Maryland, no.
What about Wisconsin?
I think Wisconsin is the interesting one. That's where Santorum has focused his attention. That's where he's chosen to kind of roll the dice. All the latest polls show Romney in a kind of 5-10% lead, but who will show up? You know, that's why we have elections, to see what happens. And I think that if it's, I think it's going to be Romney. If it's Romney with less than 5%, then Santorum can grab bragging rights. If it's 5 to 10% for Romney, then it's what was expected. If it's more than 10% for Romney, which is possible, I think that's more likely than a Santorum victory, then it's a powerful statement of, come on, Santorum, it's time to step aside. If Santorum wins, it'll be by a razor-thin margin. It won't change that much. Romney will still win the day on delegates.
Bob, is even a slight win in Wisconsin enough to keep Santorum sustainable in the election going forward?
I think if he gets a win, he will be going forward for sure, at least until Pennsylvania.
Okay, that makes sense. Al, do you agree?
Yeah, I agree with that. I disagree with something you said earlier.
What's that?
About Gingrich, you know, coming to life every so often. He's been a body in the road who just will occasionally twitch a little bit. And that's all he's doing.
Can I add to that?
You can.
As you said, he recharges his battery. The only batteries you can recharge are ones that aren't completely dead.
Okay.
His battery will not be rechargeable.
But now wait a minute. I mean, Newt Gingrich, I mean, you know, in the interest of austerity, he did cut his campaign by a third last week, right after the primaries. There is talk around the Beltway that a lot of the contractor bills are not being paid, but that money is being diverted into keeping his media flow going.
When the other candidates, when they saw the handwriting on the wall, stepped aside, they didn't cancel their campaign, they suspended their campaign, and that allows them to keep raising money. What Gingrich has done is a variation on suspending the campaign, so he still gets to go out and talk, which he loves to do. Last week I talked about him as a dead man walking. Now I'm going to talk about him as a dead man walking, but using a walker. Walker for next week.
Interesting, Bob.
And I'm going to suggest that somebody kick the walker out from under it.
Okay, yeah, all right. There's a new perspective. Ralph.
Just think if he came out and endorsed Romney, how much talking he could do down the line as a surrogate for Romney and continue to build his credibility.
Okay, all right. But, Alan, what are the chances? I think that there's a better chance of me growing wings and flying around the Beltway inside the ADIS before Romney actually gets an endorsement from Gingrich. Is that accurate?
Not a greater chance. An equal chance.
Oh, really? Oh, okay. That's fair enough. Yeah. Al.
On the other hand, who would want him out talking for them?
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
He
right.
is
that's
totally
point.
Under
that's control. Right.
That's going to go to my next point. I was going to say.
But Gingrich wants to be relevant in this debate.
Maybe in Georgia.
Maybe in Georgia. But here's the question for you. Bob Hines, is an endorsement by Gingrich at this point a handicap for Romney if he were to get the entire GOP around him?
Well, I don't know that it's a handicap, because obviously you can't stop, it shouldn't redound against Romney because you can't force somebody not to endorse you. But the fact of the matter is, I doubt that Gingrich is going to do it until the very last minute, and I doubt that anybody will care, even if he does.
Now, Congressman Al, go ahead.
I used this as a tell me a story a couple of 3 or 4 weeks ago. I think Newt Gingrich's ego is such that he will play this out to the bitter end and then blame all of his opponents and the public for not being capable of understanding big ideas, and in that way try to save some self-respect.
By the way, I just want to talk real quickly. There's breaking news coming out of the Dallas-Fort Worth area in Texas. There has been several, at least three confirmed tornadoes in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. The reports are sketchy. They're coming in, but it hit a fairly industrialized area out west of the Dallas Metroplex. We're going to keep an eye on that story, see what comes out of that. But more twisters are in the forecast. So for any of our listeners out there in Texas, please be safe. Back to the primary. When we look at Gingrich's endorsement, the next question is, will Santorum finally get behind somebody like Romney if, in fact, he loses in Wisconsin and decides to suspend campaign? Bob?
He's more likely to do something that will be unifying rather than Gingrich. I think, I mean, Santorum probably is wise enough to realize he's not going to get the nomination. He wants to be a player. It's pretty clear to me that he wants to be a significant member of the elite, if you will, the leadership of the party, one way or another. One way to do that is to generously endorse Romney when things go sour on him, as they probably will in the next few weeks. So I would think he has much more. He's much more likely to be, a unifier and a player in the game than is Mr. Gingrich.
Alan, Santorum has the unique ability to be able to say, I actually endorsed Romney before I opposed him.
Yeah.
And now, in a true Back to the Future move, he will come back and he will embrace Romney with great enthusiasm, but I'm afraid the damage between those two is done, at least for now, although Romney, and Gingrich will come around too eventually, I think, and Romney will say, oh, I welcome these guys, and they'll even have a few photo ops together. We're united now, ready to go on and tackle the common enemy.
Strange bedfellows they make.
Yeah.
Looking at Wisconsin in particular, I mean, Wisconsin is not a winner-take-all state. It is winner-takes about 18 of the delegates, and the rest is divided up amongst candidates by congressional district.
Yep.
The fight now is for the Milwaukee and metropolitan area around Milwaukee, which is southeastern Wisconsin, along the lakefront. And then the other fight is up around the Green Bay-Appleton area, just at the foot of Green Bay itself. Two very heavily populated areas. Madison will obviously, the heart of the People's Republic of Madison, will probably have Republicans going for Romney. But that Green Bay area and that northern central part could be a great breeding ground for Santorum. Could Santorum still claim victory if he still gets enough of the congressional districts to go behind him, even though he's not the total count winner? Bob?
I'm thinking that it's going to be a victory for Romney in Wisconsin. I don't think it's going to be a landslide by any means, but I think he's going to win.
But is the total delegate count going to be a factor in maybe helping get Santorum to Pennsylvania, Alan Moore?
Well, if Romney wins, which we think he will win most of the delegates. Having said that, Santorum has mastered the technique of claiming victory no matter how bad the defeat.
Is that a smart move on Santorum's part, Congressman Al?
If he wants to get to Pennsylvania, yes.
Can he sustain that argument into Pennsylvania?
Yes.
Verbose as always. Thank you, Congressman Al.
No, I'm sure he will not leave until after Pennsylvania.
Really?
He'll be in the race at least that long.
Ralph?
Santorum's already gone on the record to say that there are five more primaries in May, and he's looking good in Texas, Kentucky, and Indiana. So I don't see him dropping out before May. I see him winning a couple more of these states and holding on through at least the summer.
But Congressman Al,
his trick is to stay in as long as he can and know precisely when to drop out and endorse Romney.
Yeah.
That will get him on the podium at the convention. It will give him the leadership position, or at least position him to have a leader position, to be a leader of the Republican Party.
It's hard to say Republican Party, isn't it, Al?
Well, it sticks in my throat. And if he carries that out to the bitter end, I think he reduces his chances. Now, Gingrich hadn't got a prayer, and I think he's going to stay in forever. And I think that Paul is going to stay in forever because he wants to get a place in the speaking on the platform so that he can preach his ideas. And I think that they will let him do that, and I think they'll let Santorum do it. I don't think there's a prayer in hell of Gingrich having anything to, I don't know that they'd let him in.
Carl?
I think one of the things we have to do is watch what happens to Santorum in Pennsylvania. If he gets really rolled in Pennsylvania, then he might, at that point, get out of the race and not wait for Texas and the other states that he feels he has a shot at.
Alan Moore, is that a possibility? I mean, we're talking about a state that unseated him not that long ago, and there's still some bitter bridges that he's burned in that state. Is a Pennsylvania win even plausible for Santorum?
Well, Santorum currently has a lead among Republicans. Remember, he was elected there to the House and to the Senate. He was the nominee of the party. He lost by 18 points.
Which is a thumping.
To the Democrat, a huge, embarrassing thumping. But he lost to Democrats. It's not clear that he lost to Republicans, although he has the ability, as we've seen, to turn off Republicans and Democrats. So what will be interesting is if it's close or if Romney should pull out a victory, which I think is possible. And depending upon what happens today, and there are five other primaries April 24th, the same day as Pennsylvania, and they're big ones. It's New York, it's Delaware, it's Connecticut, it's Rhode Island as well. As Pennsylvania,
but those are states that Santorum doesn't really have a chance in.
But he can't ignore them completely and put everything into Pennsylvania because he doesn't want to get completely stomped on the delegate count. He has got to win in Pennsylvania to maintain credibility. And Romney will devote time, and the super PAC will be there. That would be an interesting one. He could lose it. If he does lose it, I agree with Carl, he's finished. He's been completely finished.
Bob Hines, looking at the must win, right now under the current delegate vote, and let's say that even Mitt Romney pulls in 60% or even 55% of the total delegate count going out today in today's primaries, Santorum would still have to win over 80% of the total delegates going forward to even consider being nominated in Tampa. That is a number that we've not seen, at least in modern history.
The chances of him doing that are as close to zero as you can get. Take, for example, we were just talking about the Pennsylvania race and the other races that day. I don't think there's any other state that Mr. Santorum has a good chance of winning. Pennsylvania, I think it'll be a close race. He may win that, but that may be all he wins.
But the delegate count in Rhode Island, New York, Connecticut,
it'll
far outweighs
swamps
what he gets in Pennsylvania.
It swamps him. I mean, he could, Santorum could win 80% of the vote in Pennsylvania and still lose three quarters of the delegates that are provided for in the race that day.
Congressman Al,
it would seem to me that would be the timing for him to withdraw,
gracefully
get through Pennsylvania, and hopefully, you know, do fairly well, and that would be the time for him to bow out gracefully. Continuing past then, I think he's starting to burn bridges.
But Alan Moore, when we look at, for example, Mitt Romney, who again presumptive front runner, if you look at some of the polling, and again, we're going to get some of the deep inside the Beltway weeds right now, but it's still something to consider. Mitt Romney has an issue. His issue is that his positives are equal to his negatives, almost one-to-one. In some cases, his negatives outweigh, but the Republicans still back him. How can he overcome that range?
Well, his negatives are driven by the negative campaigns that Gingrich and then Santorum have run. Remember, he may not have the positive-negative split that one would like, but you compare him to Santorum and Gingrich, and he's just the golden boy. So when the party comes back together, which it will, you talked to him about the presumptive front runner. No, he's the front runner. He's the presumptive nominee, and that's not going to just flip his positive-negative numbers instantly, but it'll at least wash out this inside the party negativity, and there'll be some chance to unify. It'll be then be the Democrats who are going to be dumping all over Romney, and that's already begun.
Is Bob Hines, is the Scott Walker factor in Wisconsin something that we need to look at? The Republican Party in Wisconsin is driven in backing their governor, but they've got a huge fight in their hands and a governor that is arguably staring down the barrel of a possible indictment. Is that enough of a motivation to get the non-establishment base out into Wisconsin?
You use the word indictment. I mean impeachment.
Impeachment. I'm sorry, impeachment. I apologize. Impeachment. He's still looking down the barrel of an impeachment vote. Is that enough to get the Republican base out there to vote for Santorum?
Well, he's looking down. What's coming up in a couple of weeks is a recall.
Mm-hmm.
June 5th.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah. And he's got to deal with that now, and there's a primary before that, of course. I mean, there's about three different elections going to be going on in Wisconsin over the next 6 weeks. It's amazing how many you're going to have election after election. In any event, I think that the troubles of the governor have with respect to the public unions is a serious problem for him, and I don't know it's going to spill over into the campaign or not. It almost has to in one sense. Because it's a situation where the unions are so upset. But the fact of the matter is, most of those folks aren't going to be voting in the Republican primary anyway.
Congressman Al.
The reality is, I think that's a separate issue completely.
Congressman Al, you agree with that? Or is there maybe a factor that says Republicans are going to get out, they're just so riled up, ready to vote, they'll vote strong today, and possibly give Santorum somewhat of a little edge?
I think it's possible that they may... reorganize and get them come out and prevent the impeachment and then be exhausted. So it's not necessary that's going to carry through all the elections.
Interesting. Alan Moore.
Yeah, just, Wisconsin's today. So we'll see after the end of today where those two guys are. But the attention of Republicans in Wisconsin these days is not on Santorum versus Romney, it's on the recall.
Ralph,
I was going to say, I think at the end of the day, it looks very good for Romney in Wisconsin, and their strategy now is to go in for the kill to beat Santorum in Pennsylvania. From what I understand, talking with people in the Romney campaign, that they seem to think they have the edge in the delegates in Pennsylvania when it comes down to it.
Congressman Al.
Let me reveal my ignorance, and this may be enlightening to some of our listeners. What are the three elections and what order do they come in Wisconsin?
The understanding is today the primary, June 5th, the recall.
That's the presidential primary.
That's the presidential primary today.
Right.
A recall on the early in June.
June 5th.
And then a
series of primaries in middle of June, around June 12th,
I think.
For the state house.
The primaries,
The primaries are for either open seats or normal party primaries for other vacant statewide offices.
State primaries. Because there's a mayor of Milwaukee.
Milwaukee County.
Who's running against the governor. For seat.
Tom Barrett.
Barrett.
Right.
And is that combined?
That's the June 5th.
That's the June 5th.
Correct.
Correct.
If Barrett wins,
but there's a couple. Aren't there a couple of Democratic candidates who are running?
There's three of them.
And there may be a runoff after that.
Right.
So that would be the third big election.
Okay. Let's take a break real quick. When we come back, we're going to switch gears and talk about the Obama administration really taking shots at two things. One, the Ryan budget that was put forward. He's really taking snipes at the Ryan budget. And two, his talk on the Supreme Court. I want to follow up on what we were talking about last week. The rumors flying around about the Supreme Court and Obamacare rulings are buzzing here in Washington, D.C. One last question before we go. I love these round the table. Who's the big winner today, Romney, Santorum, or Gingrich? Congressman Al.
Gingrich?
I have to throw it in there. We talked about it. We don't talk about Congressman Paul anymore. But
none of the above.
Yeah, none of the, who's the big winner today?
Romney.
Alan Moore?
Romney.
Bob?
Romney.
Carl?
Romney.
Ralph?
Romney.
That's Romney. There we go. We'll be back in 3 minutes. This is Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., live on Blog Talk Radio. We'll be back in 3 minutes. Stay with us. we're back here live at Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio. It's 7 minutes before the top of the hour, and apparently Congressman Al and Bob Hines have taken elders' privilege and called happy hour early. You know, not that we got to do a radio show live or anything, guys, but come back whenever you feel like it. We're good.
Welcome. I'm back.
Oh, very good, because we were waiting on bated breath for you. Hey, we were talking last week about Obamacare and the 3 days of marathon trial and presentations and briefs being filed to the Supreme Court on the legality of Obamacare. The Obama administration of recent, and particularly this week, has come out sniping the Supreme Court, which is kind of shocking, considering the buzz that's going around Washington, D.C. First, let's talk about the buzz. After last week and after all the dust settled, it seems like the buzz is going that there could be severability in our future, that the Supreme Court may divide this up into three or four equal parts and rule on the three or four equal parts itself. But at the same time, there are also people that are saying that they're going to rule on it all or nothing at all. Going back to one of the justices' comments that said, you know, if we take out one part, why don't we just take it all out and let you guys go back to the drawing table? I go to you, Bob Hines. First, I know Bob, but I'll come out with you early. Bob, when we look at the aftermath and the dust settling in the Supreme Court, is severability a reality? Is that a possibility on the justices?
Yes, of course it is. They have they can do anything. They can do almost anything they want to do, actually, and they can sever. They can divide the bill and take out pieces they think are unconstitutional, leave the rest of it alone. That may not be. Now that would require further legislation to enact some kind of a revenue measure, which, you know, that's what the mandate is. And but they can take the whole thing down. They can take a piece of it out. They have a right to divide it up, severability, as they call it. And they spent an hour and a half on, you know, discussing just that issue.
Well, Ralph, you were at one of the hearings that day early on. Did you get the sense that severability might be just an easy band-aid for them to put over this, and they could rule it piecemeal?
Well, I think if the mandate is declared unconstitutional, but the rest of the bill is found constitutional, I think it still plays in Obama's favor, especially because the Obama administration advocates health care as an issue of fairness, as opposed to the conservatives that are pushing the issue of freedom. And I think the Supreme Court, if they just strike down the mandate, I don't think it's going to hurt Obama.
Alan Moore, is it politically safe or politically sound for the Supremes to sever this bill up and deliver it to us dissected?
I don't feel qualified to talk about whether it's politically sound, because I'm one of the few probably around who don't think that the Supreme Court spends a whole lot of time thinking about the politics. So I don't think they make decisions based on is it good politics or bad. Now, on an individual case, from time to time, there may be a justice who lets that come in.
Let me rephrase the question to you. Not saying that the Supremes are going to do this politically biased. There's a certain inherent faith that we have in the Supreme Court that they're going to do it strictly on the constitutionality and the legality of the bill itself. Is it legal? Does it meet the requirements of the Constitution? When I say, is it politically sound? Is it politically sound for the Obama administration to have this severed up and delivered piecemeal? Is it somewhat of a shallow victory for the administration?
Well, the administration is in a really interesting position. I hope we talk about the comments that the president has made in advance of a Supreme Court decision about his thoughts about this and the signals he's sending. This is troubling stuff for me. I've not been a fan of the president publicly at a State of the Union taking issue with a Supreme Court decision. That's basically he can drive the justices out of attending, which I don't think is a particularly good thing. And this is kind of in that same family of controversial issues.
what is he exactly trying to achieve? As some have suggested, maybe he got tipped off on what they're thinking. I doubt that. I would be flabbergasted if that was the case. I don't think that's it. I think he's decided to very careful, strategic decision to take this position. So if they decide in favor of him, he says he'll be able to say, yeah, I helped influence their decision. If he fails, he'll say, I warned you folks, that's a problem. And I'm just troubled by him being aggressive, and I'll have more to say about that.
Let's go to that real quickly. Al, I'll let you comment, and then we'll talk about the president's comments. Al, go ahead.
Well, I was going to talk about the president's comments. There's another way to interpret it. This may be setting up essentially what he will be campaigning on as far as this issue is concerned. And he's starting early to make his points about it. He makes them very succinctly, and I think he makes them very well. And why wait until after it's over? He has the possibility he can cow them. I think that's highly unlikely, and I think the president does too. But he will be in the position of saying, I told them that yada-da, 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 and now look what we got to do and make a campaign issue.
Well, let's look at one of the comments. I mean, one of the really telling comments was a comment that the president made over at the White House where he said, quote, I just remind conservative commentators that for years what we've heard is the biggest problem on the bench was judicial activism or a lack of judicial restraint. He continues, that an unelected group of people would somehow overturn a duly constituted passed law, unquote. He follows that up by saying, well, this is a good example, and I'm pretty confident that this court will recognize that and not take that step. Alan, that's a pretty sharp jab at not only the court, but at Chief Justice Roberts.
Well, we'll see who it's a sharp jab at. I totally agree with Al that he's setting himself up for the fall. I don't have any dispute with that. But it was Obama himself in his campaign with Hillary Clinton, when she was an advocate for a mandate, who said, I don't think you can do that. I don't think you can force people to do that. He was basically making the constitutional argument as the constitutional professor. Now he's all of a sudden doing this interesting pivot where he says, gee, you know, how do you overrule a legislated law? I'll tell you how. In 1803, there was a court decision in the Supreme Court called Marbury versus Madison, where they decided, yes, it is constitutional for the Supreme Court to decide that a law passed and signed by the president is unconstitutional. That's what the question is now before the court. Everybody knows it was passed. He said, oh, passed by large majorities. Yeah, a majority of 7 in the House of Representatives. And now he's trying to have it both ways.
Congressman Al.
I think that of the three things he said in the statement you quoted, the first one, I think, is very interesting. It's essentially political, but it is true that the Republicans have been bitching and moaning for years about judicial
judicial activism,
and this court has a number of times been judicially active, so I think that's a good point. The second point, that they can't overrule a law that's been passed appropriately, is pure nonsense. What else is the Supreme Court there for? It's not to take up those kinds of things.
And the bottom line is the Supreme Court is going to rule on whether the power of Congress is constitutional or not, not the presidential power.
All right.
And that's the bottom line.
Bob Hines.
And the thing that I was most surprised by that he said, here's a quote, constitutional law professor, and he's attacking the Supreme Court as a bunch of unelected people. And that's what the Constitution says, that it sets up just that body. The idea of him using that kind of language is just, it's beyond the pale as far as I'm concerned.
Surprises me.
Yeah, Carl.
It's insane.
Yeah.
You know, President Clinton also jumped in on this whole conversation. And he quotes a 1942 decision where a farmer was told that he could not grow food for his own consumption, that this was affected the aggregate of the amount of food consumed in interstate commerce and the price of food. He also quoted George Washington, which he thought had signed a bill saying that all people in the United States should own a gun because there was a possibility that the British might come back and try to fight us again. And this is, had nothing to do with keeping bare arms. And John Adams, another framer, introduced a bill and passed it for individual seamen to buy hospitalization insurance. So here were mandates that had come down from the framers, and he aimed his comments on Justice Scalia, who loves the framers, and he put out these different examples of where mandates had been done.
Okay, Bob, you have a comment?
Nope.
I thought you were motioning me. Alan Moore, you have a comment?
Yeah, there was another interesting little inconsistency with what the president was talking about and what he's been doing lately. Has to do with a different law legally passed in 1996 called the Defense of Marriage Act.
DOMA.
Now, I personally think DOMA is an abomination, okay? So let's just get that out there, and I'd love to see it overturned. But it passed by huge majorities by Republicans and Democrats and was signed by Clinton. And DOMA has to do with defining marriage as a union between a man and a woman only. Says that if somebody's legally married in one state, another state does not have to recognize that. And most of all said, no federal program may give any benefits to same-sex couples. Now, what passed by the legislature, signed by a Democratic president, law of the land, and President Obama now, in the last year, said, he went beyond saying, I think we should repeal it, fair enough, but he said, I think it's unconstitutional, and we are no longer going to defend cases challenging DOMA in the courts. So, here is a guy, not that it's unusual for a politician trying to have it both ways, but on the very point that he's talking about, he is doing exactly the same thing.
But Bob Hines, this is a president who was attacked before. I mean, he's done it in the bully pulpit of the State of the Union address back in 2010, Justice Alito. He basically mouthed and was on camera saying that's not true, talking about the Citizens United case. So this is not new for a quote-unquote constitutional law. Is his credibility being drawn back?
Well, you know, we're talking about some pretty esoteric areas when we start talking about, you know, how you're dealing with the constitutional legislation. But the fact of the matter is that the president has on more than one occasion in effect, said things, or said he was going to do things, like not enforcing a law, like, you know, and that. What message does that send to the public?
Well, Ralph Woody, go ahead. But you know, at the same time, it's ironic that we see. It's almost like the argument of the Democrats mirror the argument of the Republicans. The Republicans have said the same thing about judicial advocates, advocates. I can't even say that
judicial
word.
Activism.
Thank you. Right. You know, the Republicans have argued about judicial activism for years during the Clinton administration.
You're falling into, by putting the question that way, I think you're falling into the trap that the president intends, that it is not activist to look at a constitutional challenge and make a judgment that a particular law is unconstitutional just because it's the law. Again, it goes back to this 1803 case. That's something they do. What Republicans argue that the court has done in the past is carve out new rights, find new rights in the Constitution. And Roe v. Wade would be prime among them, where a court discovered a right to an abortion under a right to privacy that they discovered in the Constitution that obviously the framers weren't thinking about. That's what they think about as judicial activism, creating things that don't exist, not striking down as unconstitutional, whether one agrees or not. But it's two different things. They're not the same.
Picking and choosing from different amendments, the penumbra, well, what the court said.
Congressman Al,
can you, is there any way you can argue that it was not judicial activism that had the Supreme Court wipe out about 50 years of law with regard to campaign finance?
Right. Well, the Citizens United vote is definitely something in play here. Bob Hines.
Well, listen, the court in its history has changed the Constitution in some ways. The Dred Scott decision was a change in the law. Plessy versus Ferguson was a fundamental addition to the law.
But was that judicial activism?
Sure it is.
Is it? I
mean, if you decide activism is going beyond what is clear today and saying this is a reasonable movement forward or sideways or whatever. If the court says that, that's activism, because that is finding something within the framework of the Constitution that is not explicitly there but follows reasonably from something that they have decided is a reasonable fit within the Constitution. And the question today is with the Obamacare and the accountability bill, the health bill, is the question of, is this a reasonable extension of the federal authority, or is it something that goes beyond that because it requires someone who doesn't want to buy insurance to do it or else?
But we're seeing a president literally going after the legitimacy of the third branch of tricameral government. I mean, he's going after it aggressively. Now, Jim Clyburn said the other day that Congress can't go after the Supreme Court this aggressively, but he says that in fact the president should go after and try, in some instances, almost intimidate the Supreme Court into submission.
Well,
at Congressman Al.
Other presidents have done this.
Truman arguably did it.
FDR tried to back the court. And you go back to Andrew Jackson did something that offended the court deeply. I've forgotten what it was.
I'm not sure what it was, but I remember his quote, "The court has made its decision. Let it enforce it."
And, well, that's what the Cherokee, the Trail of Tears.
And the other thing that comes to mind was the Bussett decision under Earl Warren, which is in fact the genesis of the Republicans talking about judicial activism.
But it almost seems right now that the president, to take this tone, is almost getting the sense that the other buzz hearing around town is that they may trash the entire thing in whole and send it back to the drawing board.
Nope.
Alan Moore.
I think that Al was exactly on point earlier. He said, I think he's just setting himself up for the fall. For the fall election, not for a physical fall. That win or lose, no matter what the court does, he can say, well, we survived this one, but who knows what will happen next time. We need justices on the Supreme Court who will not take it upon themselves to undo established law and undo the things we want unless we disagree. Yeah. But I think it's a political move. It's really interesting. And
is
I think
it damage control?
No, it's not damage control. It's sort of positioning himself to do damage to the other side.
Action.
Carl.
I think the Clinton quotes point to the same thing. They're setting this thing up to say, look, these things have been done in the past, and this is the way it should come out now. We've had mandates in the past by presidents, and you should rule in favor of this. It's trying it in the public and letting the public know what the stakes are. And also, you've got the fact that I think it was Scalia was quoted by somebody as saying that, didn't really anticipate the what would happen with the money part of the decision on the campaign finance, and they're a little, the judges might be a little jittery on that scope, and they might not want to make the same kind of decision on this one that is going to really have a backlash against the court.
Well, let's go around the table real quick and find out, because right now the buzz is, and we'll go around the table the Ryan sniping that the White House has been doing on his budget bill. We'll table that till next week, because there's just a lot going on here in Washington, D.C. this week. But around the table, Al, the big question is, does the Supreme Court rule on this before or after the election? Al?
I was going to say that I haven't ruled. I never predict what the Supreme Court is going to do. Now you're asking me to predict when it's going to do it. I have no idea.
Alan?
Absolutely. He'll do it in June.
Really? Bob?
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely.
June.
Carl?
June.
Ralph?
I agree. I think it'll be in June.
I think that
I changed my mind. It's June.
All right. Well, I'm going to be the one to censor. I think they punt. I think that the president has politicized this so much, I think the Supreme Court's going to punt this until it meets after the election in November. Just my take.
Interesting
take.
Crazy idea, but interesting.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah, yeah. What a crazy idea.
I'm telling you, I think they're going to punt.
You understand, don't you, that they took a preliminary vote last Friday.
Right. I'm telling you, I think that the justices are looking at the whole block. I think that the justices themselves are going to punt until after the election. Just my take as a hack in this town. Hey, when we come back...
they'll be the hacks.
They'll be the hacks.
Wow. When we come back, we're going to take on a serious topic. We're going to talk about the Trayvon Martin shooting down in Sanford, Florida, and the political and the social ramifications of what's going on. Joining us is going to be D.C. political activist and longtime D.C. insider Joe Williams. Stay with us. It's going to be a good conversation. This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., on Blog Talk Radio. We'll be back in 3 minutes. Stay with us.
Of the sun and west of the moon, we'll build a dream house of love. Dear.
back live here on here at Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio. Joining the roundtable right now is D.C. community activist and longtime D.C. political insider and D.C. native, Joe Williams. Joe, welcome back to the show. Thank you.
Thank you for having me, Justin. Good to see all
of you. Always love having you here. It's always good talk when you're around. Joe, as many people in the country have been following, you've probably been following the Trayvon Martin case, the situation where Trayvon Martin, a 14-year-old young man, a 17-year-old young man in Sanford, Florida, walking through a gated community, is shot fatally by a community watch activist who had a license to carry a concealed weapon in the state of Florida. As of today, the supposed attacker, George Zimmerman, has not been charged with a crime, and they are citing Florida's Stand Your Ground rule. Basically, in total, why should and why does the country need to take a look at what's happening in the Trayvon Martin case? Why is this something that is captivating our attention right now, Joe?
Well, I think that if you began to look back historically, whenever there's a people or community that has faced pain, pain can easily be brought up or old wounds can be opened. And I think in this case, what we have is we have old wounds that have been opened up regarding justice or injustice, if you would, regarding a certain race of people. I think the challenge in the Trayvon Martin case is bigger than an individual who felt like he was doing a civic duty coming up against a individual who he thought was misplaced and out of place. You have the law, in fact, that you have to consider, because if you're in the district, Maryland and Virginia area, if in fact that you, quote unquote, said that you did something based on self-defense, you would still be arrested and charged with a manslaughter and have to prove your self-defense case. In this instance, that's not happening because of the right to stand ground law in Florida. The other piece of it is that what we find is that, and we don't like to have these discussions, but the reality is that we think that we live in a post-racial country, and we don't. We are a country that has a real bad habit of kind of putting some things under the rug and hope that the dirt will fly out on the other side. And that's just not going to be the case. In this instance in particular, this is a painful piece just because this young man was walking in a gated community in which his father lived. His father's fiance lived there. So he wasn't out of place, but there was a thought, if you would, if you listen to the tapes and the transcripts, that where this individual's thought that he was. And so there was a stereotype, so to speak, that was there.
There seems to be a lot of fact and rumor flying around about this case. But if you look at it as a whole, there are some that believe that, look, the Florida Stand Your Ground rule is in fact wrong. There are some that believe that the federal government and in many instances the state of Florida is getting involved in something that is very specifically a case for the district attorney's office in Seminole County, Florida. But there's also been rumors about what exactly happened, who's talking on the tapes. There's a lot of innuendo. Is this being, in fact, in your opinion, is this being tried in the media right now? Or is the other side, the law enforcement side, saying, let us do our job and investigate it properly? The fact that he has not been charged, he being Zimmerman, is just part of the investigative process. Is that fair?
Well, no, I don't think that's necessarily fair. I mean, I don't think it's being tried at all. I think it's just being commentated upon. People have opinions. Opinions are like noses. Everybody has one. You're able to bring your opinion to bear on whatever you choose to do. You know, one of the things that we have to keep in mind is that the Constitution says we the people, not we some of the people. And we have to be mindful of the fact that when somebody's rights are jeopardized or seemingly as such, there needs to be a thorough investigation into it, and there needs to be some real work done. There's so much stuff that has gone on to the he say, she say, the roundabout things that have come out, and we don't really know the truth in this case. I mean, you know, the individual...
I mean, arguably, the case is still being investigated.
Well, yes, but remember, the Sanford police chief stepped away from it because he felt like he was doing more damage than good, which to me as a law enforcement individual, you are trained to do just that, to uncover and investigate and define facts. And for you to step away immediately says that there was something there.
Interesting point. Very interesting point. When we look at some of the activities that have happened, Reverend Al Sharp that has gotten involved and created these large town hall meetings, Reverend Jesse Jackson, both of whom have gone to Sanford, Florida, when you look at the facts surrounding that, is there a certain politicalization of the Trevin Martin shooting that's going on right now?
I think that what's happening within the black community, and I'll tell you honestly, is that there is a need to attack apathy. You know, I was raised to get a good education will lead me to getting a good job, and I will be able to be a very viable and vital contributor to our society, all right? And I have found in my own life that that's not necessarily the case. There's just some walls you got to go through. I believe that one of the things that many individuals like Reverend Jackson and Reverend Sharp have been doing is trying to wake up those who are asleep.
But where does the politicalization start and end, in your opinion? Do we allow the case to, in fact, go through the law and order process of police criminal investigation, the case being brought to the district attorney, it being either prosecuted or not being brought forward to court, or is this part of a politicalization effort to bring and force the hand of the district attorney to say, look, stand your ground is only so much. I've still got a quote-unquote a manslaughter charge that could be pending.
I think that you have a two-tier piece here in terms of your question. One, the Sanford law enforcement, the police people allowed themselves to let this thing string out too long and not to bring a swift action to it. They could have presented what we call hard case evidence to say, this is what we have to stand by, and then did that immediately, I think we might be at a different place. I think you'll still have people angry. You'll still have people more troubled by it. But I think that, you know, it has gotten to where it is now because they just kind of pushed it away and didn't do anything immediate about it.
Does, in your opinion, I mean, right now we've got several investigations going on. The Attorney General Eric Holder has commissioned a special investigation task force for DOJ down in Sanford, Florida, to investigate this independently of the district attorney. The Attorney General in Florida, Pam Bondi, a Republican, has commissioned her own task force to investigate this. FDLE, the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, has their own. Are there too many hands at this fire to truly try this case correctly?
Yeah, I think the bigger question, Justin, is why is it that these people had to come into this small community and to do all of this? Why isn't the system that is already in place in terms of our own law enforcement laws, why weren't they capable of addressing this immediately? Because once you open that floodgate, then you're going to have all these hands in the pot.
Did the media, in fact, maybe force the hand in some of this? I mean, you're talking about a successful district attorney with years of experience, and again, not questioning the fact that, first of all, the loss of life of any youth is just a tragedy unto itself. When it comes under questionable circumstances, which have not been investigated, into itself just creates a larger volume of rumor and innuendo about both sides. Is in fact that these people getting involved and not letting the district attorney do his case, is that in fact hampering the investigation? Are there too many hands in the fire?
Well, again, I would say that the situation forced the hands to come in because there were some things that just were not addressed. I mean, let's take it here. I mean, the trouble is with this case is that people are trying to make it a racial issue. And let me just say from the beginning, I don't think that's what this is.
What is it?
I think it's a human issue.
How so?
And I say a human issue because of the fact that we all have our frame of minds, our stereotypes, and if in fact that an individual can stereotype you, you know, based on what they see and not based on just what the fact the Constitution protects you of, the Constitution allows you to walk in a community, whether you're wearing a hoodie or a suit, all right? And so you shouldn't be stereotyped by that. And what we have is that we have our country. We're still stereotypical when it comes to people. And I'm not saying that, I mean, it goes across the lines. You know, black, white, white, black, you know, Asian, Indian, the whole nine yards. And so I'm saying to you that in this case, that the law enforcement folk who had it immediately made some missteps that opened the floodgates for everybody else.
I want to turn to Congressman Al real quick. Congressman Al, you've been a supporter and a critic of the media coverage on certain high-profile cases, former Emmy Award-winning broadcaster yourself. Do you feel that maybe that this has been too politicized on 30-second soundbites in the 24-hour news cycle?
Well, I have to agree with Joe in the sense that had they done something quickly, there would have been less room for the media to come in and start the process of asking questions for which there are no immediate answers. So, for example, the police, as I understand it, didn't really treat it as a crime scene. So who knows what evidence has been destroyed that would have otherwise been useful in investigating the area. I just think that I am very critical of the media frequently for good reason. But if you leave something like this, a young man is killed, a community watch guy with the perfect right to carry the gun under Florida law uses it. He's injured. In the back of his head, and apparently his nose was broken, and that doesn't, you know, what caused that? You leave all these questions open, and the officials aren't investigating them. You are inviting the media to come in and fill in the blanks, and that's what they do.
And Congressman, I agree with. Let me just say this too, because if you look at some of the aspects of this case, for example, you know, it came out today that the ambulance that was sent to the scene was called back that was sent for Zimmerman, was
right.
Called back, all right? So if your head is beat, bashed, and your nose is broken, why does the ambulance call back? There's just too many questions surrounding this that were not addressed immediately. And law enforcement dropped the ball on this, and now it has become a media circus to a degree. But at the same time, the open end of this is that nothing has been done regarding this whole incident in terms of coming to a conclusion and outcome.
Alan Moore.
Yeah. Obviously, it has not been resolved, but that's because you got new groups coming in trying to look fresh and trying to be responsible. I think, hopefully, before this is all over and done, we will have a pretty accurate picture of exactly what happened. There's no question that the police on the scene, understandably under the pressure they're in, didn't do all that they needed to do, and that certainly fed this. It also is undeniable that there were differences of opinion among the authorities who went as to who should do what, because there was a recommendation by some present that Zimmerman should be charged for manslaughter, and that decision was, in effect, overruled. That recommendation was, I guess, considered, and they decided against because I guess they felt that there was plausible explanation for why Zimmerman did what he did. The fact that there was no charge made and no plan for a further investigation, that's what really fed the anger. And then as we began to uncover layers of what happened and listen to the 9/11 tapes, we began to realize that Zimmerman, who, after all, is known for being this neighborhood watch guy, who was talking to a 911 operator. He didn't just sneak up and shoot this kid.
But he
was saying, I don't want him to run. And the 911, you don't have to follow him, but he thought, you know, I don't want him to run. But there's no question either that Zimmerman was racially profiling this kid. It's a kid in a hoodie walking through the neighborhood where it doesn't look like he belongs, and that's what feeds Zimmerman. And a tragedy occurs. Will sort out who did what. But there were a series of mistakes, including, I think, what the authorities did and did not do in the immediate aftermath.
Let me just jump in here real quick and kind of talk about it, because again, let me be clear. I am not supporting what Zimmerman did. Zimmerman was told on the 911 tapes, you know, the question was asked, you know, are you following him? Yes, I am. We don't need you to do that. If a police officer had told him that, then it would be failure to obey a lawful order. However, it was a 911 operator that said, no, we got it, don't worry about it, just let him go, and he did not follow that order. It was not a lawful order. He did not disobey part of an investigation. However, I also want to state, in support of the process, everybody around the table knows, and I support law enforcement many times, I think to call into question, are there things that the Sanford Police Department, as part of their investigation, may have overlooked? Possibly. But that's then the role of the district attorney to make that determination, on top of the fact that you have a stand-your-ground law that is in effect. It is law in the state of Florida, signed into by the governor, Jeb Bush, that states that he acted within his rights under stand-your-ground, arguably, on the facts that was happening. I think that there was talk about there being some sort of charge against Zimmerman for involuntary manslaughter or first-degree manslaughter. That, again, is just speculation. But I think that in this instance, the DA, who I happen to know him and know of his history just from living down in that area, is a veteran law and order type guy. I don't think he's going to charge somebody if the law is in place. But I also don't think he's going to let somebody go on the auspices of just stand your ground if he acted with malice, like what you're saying. I think that it's arguable he was racially profiled. But I think we have to let the process go before we prosecute.
But I think the hindrance is a part of the involvement of the district attorney's office and the like. I mean, one, there has been statements that the district attorney was on site at the police station having a conversation with the police chief not long after this thing had taken place. Now, I don't know how many DAs get that involved in cases that quickly.
I will tell you right now that in any case that involves the shooting of a minor, in any case that involves the shooting of the minor, particularly in a suburban community like Seminole County, Florida, where Sanford is at, particularly in a southern suburban city of Orlando where there have been questionable racial tensions before, that DA is going to get involved and get hands-on, in my opinion. We've seen it before in that part of the state. I think that a DA is going to look at it because he knows that it's going to draw a lot of media vision.
But the DA is not brought in until the law enforcement has done their work and pulled all the evidence together to say, this is what we have to present to you before we can move forward. I'm saying the DA was there before any of that was concluded or taken place. And that, to me, is a suspicious activity. And what I'm saying is, if that is true, it has fueled all the things that have begun to happen. And so what I'm saying is that, you know, regardless of the stand your ground law, we have to ask ourselves, is that a law that is something that we need to keep on the books?
That is a good question. I think that's a very valid question. But that's a question for the voters of the state of Florida. Alan Moore.
Yeah, I just want to say something about stand your ground. As I understand it, the only way that stand your ground becomes relevant is if Trayvon attacks Zimmerman.
Which, again, there's arguable circumstances around that.
Which apparently Zimmerman has said did occur, but that's part of the investigation. And what's not really addressed here is, was Zimmerman's behavior in following him, apparently in a vehicle, so provocative and frightening to a kid that, hey, who can blame him for, in his own way, standing
his ground? Did, in fact, Trayvon Martin stand his ground?
So, you know, it wasn't that stand your ground was invoked simply because he was following a kid and then shot him when they had an argument. But stand your ground is when you feel threatened.
Right.
Zimmerman claims he was. We don't know the facts.
But here's the thing. Here's what makes this all questionable, too. You're in a car following someone, and then you get out of your car. All right. Now, if I'm in my car and somebody confronts me in my car, all right, and I'm afraid or whatever, I'm driving off because I'm in my car.
Right.
Now, if I get out my car and I confront this individual, if this individual has confronted me and I get out my car after being told not to do, to engage him, then that says something about my intent.
Okay, Alex.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about a sort of a crazy circumstance. Let's suppose for a moment that Trayvon had a gun, and a guy in a car is following him, and he's frightened about that, and then he's, what are you following me for? And the guy gets out of his car, and Trayvon shoots him. Is he then protected for stand your ground? I would guess he would be. I would guess that he would have.
In my opinion, and Joe, you and I have known each other a long time. In my opinion, I will tell you that
not
is
me
a
in
decision.
Not me in Florida.
No. I've known you a long time. I've known you a long time here in D.C. I will tell you that, in my opinion, I think that is a determination of the district attorney. That is something that the district attorney has to investigate. That is what he is sworn to do. And it should be, and the state of Florida, the state attorney general, Bondi, and Eric Holder, the attorney general of the United States, should allow the district attorney to conduct a proper investigation. If there was questionable actions by the Sanford Police Department, he can cite that and do another investigation on the Sanford Police Department.
You see, Justin, I think this, and I want to kind of switch gears for a minute, because we can talk all day about the law enforcement action. Here's where I am as a black man and as a father.
Okay.
All right, of three, and I have four grandkids. All right. Why is it that I have to tell my son and my grandsons that they have to conduct themselves in a certain way and watch what they wear, where they go, and what they do as it relates to traveling anywhere in this country? I sent my son off to school in 2009 down in Greensboro, North Carolina. And all leading up to that, it was reminding him of the fact that you are growing into a black man. There are challenges that you face as a black man. Your education is going to be a way for you to advance yourself. But there's going to be some other things you're going to have to deal with, all right? Why did I have to tell my son that when you get down to Greensboro, there's certain parts of Greensboro, you're going to have to be careful when you go in? Why is it that I, in this country, in this day and time that we live in, I mean, come on, the civil rights law was passed back in 64. I mean, there was all the marching, all the things that took place leading up to that. We said that we have the right to education and all of that. Why is it that I have to tell my son that? And why was Trayvon being stereotyped by this guy? That's the bigger question. And I think the answer is, it lies in what's within a person, how you were raised, what's brought up, and how you engage with other people.
Let me put this out there, and just for the sake of argument, Joe. I mean, my parents have had the same conversation with me about going up to certain sections of Manhattan north of 92nd Street. You got to go up there. If you go up towards Columbia University or you go up towards Greenstone, you go north of 92nd Street, back in the mid-'80s, early 90s, you had to act a certain way. I could not go down certain parts of 125th Street wearing a suit, looking like I did.
But why is that?
I don't agree with it. I'm just telling you that is a similar discussion that my parents have had with me, and I should be able to walk around those parts of Manhattan without feeling pressed, just as your son should be able to walk around all parts of Greensboro without having that conversation.
But what I'm getting at is, why is that?
Because, as you said at the beginning, I think you said, we've made some progress in this country, and we've still got a lot of work to do.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
We are not where we would like to be, notwithstanding changes in the law, changes in behavior, changes in understanding, integrated schools, and so on. There are still racial differences and racial undertones and some element of racism in the behavior of many, many people. And when it comes, and it's compounded by the fact that lots of crime in America is committed by young blacks, most of it against other blacks. And I'm guessing that inside the black community, there's a lot of do's and don'ts in our neighborhoods and what you do, where you go, how you act, and so on. It's got nothing to do with white Americans. But those...
That's only environmental. You're right.
Absolutely.
Right.
But those statistics also feed stereotypes and contribute to it. Even, I think, people who feel very strongly that they would like to wash racism out of their minds, out of their thinking, also are aware that if you see a group of young guys, whether it's black or white, frankly, if they got their, it can be white kids too, in hoodies and in low slung pants, it's like, I'm going to walk on the other side of the street. I don't like the look of those kids. So there's an age issue. There's a race issue, no question.
Well,
we're not as far as we need to be.
Let me bring up this question though, Joe, and following up on what Al was saying, is this in fact a race issue?
Well, I think you can't deny that race plays a part.
Absolutely.
I mean, you can't. I mean, you would be sticking your head in the ground like an ostrich if you say that no, race had nothing to do with this. Well, race had something to do with this. All right. I mean, here's the question: if Zimmerman saw me walking in a gated community, would he have followed me?
That's
no.
a question that only Zimmerman can answer.
Well, then,
how are you dressed?
I could be dressed down. I could not have the suit on that I have. I could not have on. I could have on a pair of jeans and a sweatshirt.
Carl, you had a question.
Yes. First of all, this is a tragedy par excellence.
Carl, can you speak up and talk to me?
Yeah.
This is a tragedy, real tragedy. And I think I brought this up last week, and I think Al hit the point again that justice might not be done in this situation, where it ought to be done, because everything is, the police dropped the ball, and everything is kind of a mishmash. Now we've got people coming in, investigating, and interviewing people, and who knows what's going to happen. I think, I agree, this is a racial situation, and a lot of us fought very hard in the 60s and before to remove this kind of a situation, but we haven't grown up enough as a nation to be accepting of everybody.
I take a little bit of exception when you talk about the law enforcement dropped the ball on this. Law enforcement has not dropped the ball on this. Still a very much active investigation.
Law enforcement hasn't picked the ball up either.
We understand where you're coming from, but the law enforcement at the outset for the first couple of weeks dropped the ball.
It didn't get things done the way it needs to.
That's why there are now three independent investigations. Why there are marches, why there are people down there, while the media is all over the place. They didn't get the job done as thoroughly as they should have. Does that mean they screwed up everything? No. The fact of the matter is there was a recommendation to charge this guy with manslaughter. They looked at the evidence in a day or two, really quickly, looked at his apparent wounds. I'm willing to believe he probably had some wounds, but...
He was the best looking beat up guy I've ever seen in my life.
There was not enough done, and now we've got multiple investigations, and even to this day we don't know exactly what happened. That tells me that dropping the ball doesn't mean they completely failed. They didn't do anything at all. It just means they didn't do everything they needed to do, and that's why we're where we are.
I gotta
They bring Zimmerman into court, and not into court, but into the police station, and you look at Zimmerman, where's the blood, where are the wounds? I mean, how did that happen?
Well,
Let me just say this.
Now, I'm from D.C. I grew up in the hood. You know the story.
Yeah.
If I'm on you as a rabid teenager, hormones from hell, and my adrenaline is up, and I am beating on you, you are not going to walk out of there looking like you just stepped out of a Hollywood scene. You're going to look as if that you've really been beat up, all right? Now, your head is banged against the ground. He's on top of you, and he's beating you, and you're crying for help. And then yet, you don't get an ambulance to take you to no hospital.
you go straight from the scene to a car to the police station. This is too, again, we talk about law enforcement dropping the ball. We're saying that they just didn't do enough evidence gathering to really support what they decided to do.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Joe, the big question still stemming from this is, has this in fact set back or created more racial tensions? Is this a step forward, two steps back situation in not just black and white, Hispanic and white, black on Hispanic, black on Asian? Is this a step backwards in the total race relations scenario in the United States?
I think it's a step back on the justice system itself. I think what people are viewing, especially the disenfranchised and the disconnected, are viewing that their rights aren't as, quote-unquote, as important as other people's rights. And I'll tell you honestly, now to say this, if that was my son, I would find Zimmerman just like the United States found Osama bin Laden. Okay? Because you just can't, if in fact that I feel as if no one is going to really deal with my hurt and pain, I lost my 17-year-old son, a promise is what this father is saying. My son had the whole world before him. And now because some guy who was told, stay in your car, leave him alone, and then somehow engaged with him, that to me has now put anger at a higher level. Now, it's not just Trayvon, but there are other cases. I believe there was a case of a young woman up in New York who was in a hospital. And who was, you remember the story, she's crying about pain, and they came and locked her up in the hospital, and she died in the jail cell, all right? This stuff didn't come out until after the whole Trayvon issue became highlighted in the media. There are things like that are taking place in this country where disenfranchised people don't feel like they are getting the good end of the justice stick.
Right. Joe, last question before we take a break. What do we have to do to help fix this? Is Trayvon Martin enough of a catalyst to get us to readdress this issue and come up with some sort of solution?
If we don't fall asleep on it, if we decide to see it through, I say we as a country, Sam, Florida has to do its part. We have to see it through. We have to really make sure that this one gets investigated as if it was a presidential assassination.
Very good. Very good. Joe, it is always a pleasure to have you here.
Glad to be here. Glad to see you, gentlemen.
Always good to have you here. When we come back, it's my favorite part of the show. It's Tell Me a Story. This is Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital. Live on Blog Talk Radio. We'll be back in 3 minutes. Stay with us.
We're live here back at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics, live on Blog Talk Radio. My favorite part of the show, where we talk about news, buzz, rumors, innuendo, going inside the Beltway, outside the Beltway, and anywhere else we can find it. This is Tell Me a Story. This week I'm going to start with Bob Hines. Bob Hines, tell me a story.
Today in Wisconsin is a significant primary with Mr. Romney and Santorum, the two principal players. I think it will be a victory for Mr. Romney. I think that it will be a major statement of his candidacy, and I suspect that Mr. Santorum will continue to fight on at least until Pennsylvania. But the same day that Pennsylvania has their election, a lot of other states do too, most of which are not friendly to him. I think that's his last gasp.
Alan Moore, tell me a story.
All right, so we know who the candidates are going to be in this election. It's going to be Obama, who's now begun to attack Romney aggressively, and it's going to be Romney, who has turned his attention to Obama. The problem is you've got this nuisance factor of Santorum. Gingrich no longer rises to the level of nuisance. And you've got 98 delegates on the in play today. Romney is going to get at least 75 of those, maybe 80.
Wow, you're handicapping
it.
Absolutely. Nice.
And as we move to, and Santorum will try to put some lipstick on this pig for himself and will not be very successful doing it. And I think there's at least a 50-50 chance as Santorum begins to realize he may not win in Pennsylvania, 50-50 chance he pulls out before April 24th and backs Romney in order not to damage his own personal reputation and franchise.
Congressman Al, tell me a story. Please tell me you have a story this week. You don't, do you?
Go two more people I made.
Carl, tell me a story.
Well, I really have two, but
you got one.
Give me one.
I'm going to give you one. I think in this political atmosphere that the Republicans at this point have shot themselves in the foot on this whole contraceptive issue and the women's issue in general. And it's proven at this point by the a lot of battleground states where President Obama maintains a good, healthy lead over Mitt Romney.
Ralph, tell me a story.
Okay, Ron Paul started very strong. We know he's faded down the stretch, but his supporters are working various state conventions, and it's possible he could have the second most a number of delegates at the Republican National Convention.
I can tell you that's true. Ron Paul is working the conventions hard. I've seen it. That's a good story.
Thank you.
Congressman Al, you want
to
wait
till...
He's got a lot to pick up. They're working it. They're working it. But yeah. Congressman Al, you have a story. You can pass them next week.
Well, but then I'd need two.
No, I'll give you a pass this week, Congressman Al.
Just
let me say this. I think that the media has downplayed Ron Paul. I think Ron Paul, while he's clearly not a major player in terms of the decision that is going to be made by the Republican Party or America in the general election, is trying to get a message out. And I think that it's a message that a lot of Americans wish they could get out. I don't agree with it. In fact, I strongly disagree with almost all of his views. But to write him off as the crazy uncle in the attic has been, I think, unfair, and unfair to the American public who have a right to know what these guys are saying.
Interesting point.
Spoken like a true crazy uncle.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I actually have a story this week. The FEC rules are continuing to be pushed to the limit, and the flexibility of them are tremendous.
We're seeing a couple of stories coming out of a couple of congressional races, one Senate race in particular, where FEC rules, there are complaints being brought by the FEC, but it seems that the FEC hasn't gotten its act together. I think the FEC could be the next big news in the administration as far as cleaning up their act and really enforcing FEC rules. That's my story for this week. Next week, we will be remote again, as we will be disparate. I know, everybody's upset. Everybody, my show! I can do what I want! It's not my show. It's not my show.
Boycott.
Us should get together and mount a revolution against.
All right, we got 60 seconds on behalf of their show. On behalf of Congressman Al, the Honorable Alan Moore, the Honorable Bob Hines, Carl, and Dr. Winnie, I'm just a moderator. I don't have any skin in this game. We'll be back live next week from a remote Chili's Back Room. This has been Backroom Politics, live from Chili's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital. Bob, take it away.
The place to be.
We'll see you next week. Thanks for joining us, folks. Good afternoon.